Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 6th, 2002. This session is Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Personal Encounters with God, dovetailing with Contemporary Psychoanalysis. Your presenter will be Michael Horn, MD. Let's listen in.
Give a prayer of thanks. Gracious and loving God, thank you for being with us the last few days during some difficult explorations of some difficult topics, and we pray that you will go with us as we leave and as we, some of us, stay and further reflect on the wonders of your creation. Through Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, I changed the topic for today because we were going to do 2 days bringing this topic because it's quite a big topic. But everybody was asking for more of what we did last night. So we'll try and not condense it, but highlight some of the things that we've been talking about. Because many of the ideas we've been talking about come into contemporary psychoanalysis. What I thought I'd do is just give you a little bit of an idea of what it's like if you are a patient, or really in an analytic setting, it's not you're a participant, because patient's really too much of a passive word, or even client is sometimes too objectified. So you're probably all aware that psychoanalysis began with Freud about 100 years ago. Everyone heard of Freud, Sigmund Freud, yes. And I think I talked a little bit about him. It's important to sort of start off with Freud, because he was a rather amazing person and made several of the important discoveries of psychoanalysis. But on the other hand, once he'd made those discoveries, I think he got frightened. Nancy Reeves was talking to me about this last night, because it's very much in relation to trauma. I think what he discovered was too scary for him at the time, and he sort of retreated from what he figured out. Because he was a neurologist, an internist, he wasn't a psychiatrist, and in his practice he was seeing people with what we call conversion disorders, where difficulty speaking, or sometimes some loss of vision, some loss of hearing, even some sensation problems, and then the worst case is various forms of paralysis, but also various forms of internal organ disorders too, like upset stomach and constipation, and just the body's expression of psychological problems. And about this time, people were beginning to figure out that the body expressed psychological issues, and these were called conversion disorders. And very puzzling as to how the body could do this, how the mind could have problems and create things in the body. So in France, there was a physician called Charcot. Has anyone heard of Charcot? Yeah. And he was the person who revived hypnotism. Hypnotism had got a bad name in medicine, but Charcot revived it and found hypnotizing patients with conversion disorders, they would have what was called an abreaction, or a release of emotion, and some memory of, or some idea of what sort of things had generated the conversion disorders. And these were often forms of trauma, and particularly forms of abuse, and sometimes sexual abuse. So Freud was very interested in this. People were coming from all over Europe to view Charcot's demonstrations. He used to demonstrate this in front of a big audience like this. He'd hypnotize somebody. And Jung actually attended Charcot's lectures too. So everybody was heading to Paris. And Freud was very interested in what was happening, but he found that he could help people begin to have some memory or some understanding of traumatic events that had occurred just by lying them down on the couch. And here's where the famous Freudian couch comes from. It wasn't that Freud felt he didn't want to be looked at, but this is the origin of the Freudian couch. And in contemporary psychoanalysis, probably 40% of people don't use the couch anymore. I don't use the couch myself, because I think the face-to-face is a very important part of the work. So Freud's famous couch was just a form of hypnosis, and he found he could, if he just got people talking on the couch in a relaxed state, sort of a trance-like state ensued, and people began to get ideas and thoughts, and then slowly would begin to understand what had happened. So Freud sort of was the first person to really discover the effects of trauma on the body, and the idea that trauma gets sort of separated out as a sort of a whole set of events and memories and associations and understandings about oneself just gets pushed into the unconscious part of the mind. And this is the current view that you, if you've been going to Nancy's talks, you'll, this is the current view of what happens with trauma, that it just gets split off, even dissociated, so that there's not even any memory at all for the traumatic events. So Freud had discovered something rather wonderful, that he got terribly worried and frightened about this, I think, in the context of his culture, because this was a culture which was tremendous silence about abuse, particularly sexual abuse, particularly about sexual issues in general. But of course, abuse of children, because many of his patients had been abused as children, and many of them were women, of course. It's what we see these days as well. So he developed a theory of the unconscious as having what he called sexual and aggressive instincts. But what we would see these days is these are just the sexual aspects of the person, and the aggressive so-called instincts are the hurt and angry parts of split off parts of the mind, sort of pushing to get connected to the ego and begin to express themselves again. So Freud went into this instinct theory and debunked his whole trauma theory. And here's where Jung comes in, and if you were in the first session, some people were here, we talked about how Jung's idea was that the mind was split up into separate selves. And we've talked about this with the idea of the shadow. This is where his idea of the shadow comes from. And this is very much a part of contemporary psychoanalysis. Jung was miles ahead of his time here. And this is the typical idea of contemporary psychoanalysis. We don't have an id, that's what Freud called the unconscious. We're split up into parts, into selves, and we have this dominant self, which we call the ego, which we think is ourselves. Remember, it's a construct, and we actually make it up, like what we did last night. But that sort of rules our day-to-day activities, but there's all these other selves in the background. And we don't think of them in the background in some strange place, in the subconscious, which is like a dark room somewhere, or something like that. They're always there, they're always having influences on us. And sometimes they'll take us over and we'll do things, we'll say, well, I wasn't myself, which is your main self. But of course, you are being yourself. And of course, in dreams, we see this all the time. That's why Jungians are so interested in dreams. And contemporary psychoanalysts in general are interested in dreams, but Jungians in particular, because it goes back to Jung's original insights. And once he got the idea that there were multiple selves, he then said, wow, this is what's going, looks like this is what's going on in dreams. And he was able to use dream relationships to help patients understand their day-to-day relationships with themselves, their inner selves. Now the other thing that's very important, and this is what we see in shadow phenomena in culture, is that the inner selves get what we call projected. They get attributed to other people. So the things we don't want to know about ourselves, we attribute to others, and we all pretty much familiar with this phenomenon. Most of us who've reflected on ourselves at all are pretty much aware of this. And we see all sorts of references to this in the Bible, and all sorts of references to taking back the other. The Good Samaritan story is just the one we all know. It's a very simple one in this respect. So it's a very well-known in a certain sense, but not sort of brought to the forefront. Psychoanalysis, particularly Jung, brought this to the forefront. Everyone okay so far? No. Any questions? Does this all sounds okay?
Could you just tell a little bit about how you see that good? Was it not Good Samaritan?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. How you see that? You know, in psychoanalytic.
Right. No, I'm getting to that. I just want to give you a little bit of background, and then you'll go into what we do. Because what we do really, it's just bringing this background theory to life. The theory in psychoanalysis has been developed with patients. It's all been pretty much developed through the experience with patients. you can't really do experiments on psychoanalysis because there's so many factors, and every human being is so individual that to do experiments like you would do in clinical psychology is very difficult. So this is slowly being worked out, and of course it'll evolve even more because it's not fully worked out, but worked out with patients. So it's very much a patient-centered thing. I'll get to that in a little while. Okay, well, you might wonder how you got to conceptualize who you were. We've talked a lot about the self being a concept, just something we can say, I am a XYZ. But how did you get that way? And that's a very important part of psychoanalysis, is beginning to undo this idea of something that you think you are. So how might, we have some amateur psychologists here. I know we've got some excellent amateurs, not amateur really, almost on the professional level in this group. How might we have got to be saying, I am a happy person, I am a angry person, I am a whatever. How might that have occurred? Can the self just reference itself in a vacuum? How does a self
your
learn
life,
about itself?
Your lifetime experiences, your family, you know, where you go and see things. And
right.
So
how?
So it's all, everything that you perceive has some effect on you.
There we go. All right. The relational self. The self always develops in the context of a relationship with people, of course, with parents and important people in our early lives, but also with places. We have a relationship with places and things. So we have symbolic relationships with objects in the world and relationships with the people we come in contact with, especially in our early life. So if you think about it, the self really can't exist unless there's another. Is everyone okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's just a very fundamental idea that it can't come into being unless there's another. So what parents are actually doing, this is, most of you are older now, so you're not raising young children, although what you're doing with children is you're bringing them into being by the being of yourself, by how you are as the person you are, is how your children evolve. So they only evolve in terms of the relationships with you. So all the stuff about, you know, feeding and training and discipline, of course, is important because that's part of bringing them into being. But it's bringing them into being by the person that you are. Is everyone okay with that? So that gets us into this dialogical stuff we've been talking about, the face of the other and taking in the other and all that. Because from the get-go, we're at the mercy, really, of our parents. We're being brought into psychological life in relation to our parents. So it's an amazingly responsible task, which we all fail at miserably. Try to do the best we can. If we knew this at the time we were parents, we probably would never do it. I had a little bit of psychoanalytic knowledge at the time, but not much, thank goodness. So you're always in relation to other. And what gets mapped out or internalized in your mind is the representation of yourself in relationship to the other. So I am a happy person. It's actually some part of your mind is telling you you're a happy person. That's been your experiences. Well, I am a defiant person. That would be one that's easy to figure out. You know, if we told, what a defiant little boy you are. Well, I am a defiant person, but in my mind still is that voice. So we carry all these voices around with us in our minds, telling us, I am this, I am that, I am the other. Everyone okay so far? Familiar with these voices? Familiar with inner dialogue? Right? That we're always talking to ourselves? Right. Chat, chat, chat. Sometimes it's annoying. You know, we're going on a beautiful walk. Chat, chat, chat.
I had a very interesting discussion with my son, who at the time was 29, and it had a rather rocky, teenage years. And he was trying to describe this, and he said, I really was who I wasn't. And I said, as a father, how was I to relate to you as you were or as you weren't?
That's terrific. All right. These voices that are telling us who we are and also telling us what to be as well, they're telling us that you're a defiant little boy. I want you to be a very good boy. So that's what Freud called the ideal for the ego. And then the other one who was beating on you, he called the super ego. And that was above the ego. But I always think that is the supervisor of the ego. That's why I talk to patients about it. So these are just organized voices inside our mind. The superego gets to sort of get organized in our mind. And we hope that we'll have a superego that doesn't make us reach to too higher ideals, and it's not too cruel and attacking. Pretty cool. So both things can go hand in hand. Is anyone aware of cruel aspects of their superego? Not up here, because we're all so relaxed. My superego is already starting to work on me because I'm leaving it. Michael, you need to make a phone call as soon as you get to Wenatchee, etc., etc. So we all know about the superego. So this is the, sorry, go ahead.
Now, we're leaving out another voice just to throw something else in the mix, because so many people, you know, who write about their spiritual path, you know, and we see as spiritual giants, will say that they had that voice of God early on that really shaped their whole rest of their life. And maybe knew at five that, you know, part of the way God was calling them, so.
Yeah, thank you, but that's coming. But the title is, how do we get closer to God through psychoanalysis? But this was the basic model got started, you see. This was Freud's basic model. And Freud was a total atheist. He was Jewish, but he was totally atheistic. Mm. And he was against all ideas of God whatsoever. So, let's see how God does get into the mix. But let's see, first of all, how you get started in psychoanalysis, just some of the basic things. What sort of people come to have psychoanalysis? It's not anything special. Any sort of person can show up. Someone who's got a deep depression on medication might come. I have two patients on medication. Other people will come through some crisis, through some loss or marriage breaking up or whatever. And then a group of people come with just a discontent with life. And usually these people are in their 40s and 50s, and sometimes older people. I have two patients in their 70s. A lifelong feeling of unfulfillment and discontent, lack of meaning, lack of purpose, those sorts of things. But psychoanalysis, of course, will work on the symptoms, because as we've talked about, both of us have talked on how symptoms are an opportunity for transformation. Symptoms just means you can go no farther with the map of the self and the other and the world that you've developed. Because what we do is we fit our sense of self into how we think the world is, and we arrange our world to fit into how we are as a self. We arrange our family's organization and values to fit in with how we think we are. This is what we talked about the other day about worlds bumping into each other, bumping into things. We need to be able to bump into things and expand our world, but if we can't, we organize our world to fit in with how we think the world should be. And you probably do that yourself to some extent, and know people who have what we call narrow worlds, very tight and narrow worlds. And if a narrow world bumps into something that it can't push away, then this view of self and other collapses, and this is when symptoms develop. Depression develops commonly around loss, or almost always around loss, and anxiety too. Okay, is everyone okay so far? We're going a bit further? All right. The other thing about the model is that we're constantly in a state of loss because we're constantly bumping into other worlds and having to accommodate to other worlds on a daily basis. But the way we're in the most difficult situation of loss is that we're aging. We're constantly aging. Even when we're going from 30 to 40, that's a very common time for people to come into psychoanalysis. So that's a very difficult transition because you're getting out of the illusion that you're not aging. And you know you're aging. So in some ways, that's a bigger crisis for people than the 40s or 50s. And of course, if you haven't gone through it in your 40s and 50s and you hit it in your 60s and 70s, it's even a bigger trauma. That you're aging, you're getting weaker, frailer, your memory's getting worse, and death is approaching. So we're constantly in this state of mourning of little pieces of our lives and little bits and pieces of our daily lives that are bumping in and knocking off and destroying aspects of who we think we are. So is everyone okay with that? So loss and mourning is just a constant dynamic in psychoanalytic theory and treatment.
You didn't mention about over 70.
What was that? Over 70, I'm sorry. I have one patient who's 78, so he's getting there, of course, but you know, anyone can be in psychoanalysis. I had a man who was 89 in analysis for a period of time. So it's a valuable help for anybody. Because what we're trying to do in analysis is we're not trying to manipulate the mind in any way. We're trying to open the mind and to discover deeper and deeper meaning about existence. And this is where God is important. Now, God was pretty much left out of psychoanalysis for many, many years, and it was only Jungians who had brought God into psychoanalysis. And what Jung figured out through his own personal experience was when Jung split with Freud, he had his own personal breakdown and then his subsequent breakthrough into new aspects of his theory, the spiritual aspects of his theory. But what he figured out, because he was so interested in dreams and images, and he had this idea of the split up personal pieces of the mind, and he had, of course, then he developed the idea of the conflict between the split off pieces of the mind and the ego. And then he saw that time and time again, all he had to do was to bring the shadow into conjunction with the ego. In analysis, he didn't have to do any interpreting per se, he just had to bring the shadow to life. So this is where his theory of amplification, which I'll talk about a little bit in greater detail in a minute, comes in. He brought to life the shadow figures by asking the person to associate various adjectives or characteristics to the shadow figures. Like for Bob's lion, I just say, Bob, just tell me about your lion. What's it look like? What sort of a lion is it, etc., etc., etc. And then slowly the lion comes to life as a psychic entity with all sorts of qualities, and eventually the lions and the snakes and the dragons and things in our dreams or in our imagination begin to take on personal characteristics, and then takes on characteristics back from very early relationships with lion-like people or sneaky people or whatever. So Jung found that all he had to do, which isn't that easy, is to bring the ego into relationship with the shadow. So you have to maintain this horrible tension that people feel when the ego does come into relationship with the shadow. And this sometimes takes months because people will go back into one side of thinking and you have to resurrect the whole issue again. And of course there's many figures in the shadow, but this is in general. And then what Jung found is the patient could tolerate this tension between ego and shadow, something else emerged in here. And he called this the transcendent function. And this often came as a new image in a dream, for example. Or even a new image in life, something that gripped somebody in a very powerful way. One of the interesting transcendent function dreams I had was that I was poling a barge down a river, what sort of a little barge thing, you know? I don't know what you call it. And there was rushes on the side of the river. You can already see it has a birth for a Christian, has some spiritual association. And a woman appeared in a long gown in the sort of bank of the river, and she's holding up a snake. And the top part of the snake was a cobra snake, and the bottom part was a garter snake. So she was bringing me a symbol of the possibilities of integrating what I was integrating, or trying to integrate at the time. It's a multi-dimensional symbol, as you can see, coming forward from a woman, too. Because remember, I had a witch as my shadow figure. So this was a benign female figure. It was me with my journey, you know, my lonely journey, because I felt I was on a lonely journey, pushing this barge, and there was nothing else on the river. I couldn't see anything. So this was a very, what we call, numinous dream. And that's a dream that I'm still trying to figure out. Numinous means, it's hard to define. It's sort of awesome and gripping, and you feel you're in the presence of something holy. And we all must have had numinous dreams. I'm not going to ask you your dreams again. I'll let you off this morning. But if you reflect on this, a numinous dream is something that you can't get out of your mind. And the symbols just sort of stand out. And sometimes you'll just have one symbol in the dream. Or sometimes you'll even just hear a statement in a numinous dream. And this is the transcendent function. And then amplifying or developing these symbols begins to help the patient see how the integration might occur between the ego and the shadow. So this was Jung's first idea of how God entered. And he developed an idea of God of his own. The idea that God was helping us work towards what he called completeness or fullness. And he developed a theory that psychoanalysis was a process of individuation or developing towards a state of wholeness or completeness. And contemporary psychoanalysis wouldn't go for this at all, because if you've heard it from me again and again and again, completeness is a problem, and wholeness is a problem. There's always something left out in wholeness. So contemporary Jungians and contemporary psychoanalysis in general doesn't like the idea of completeness or wholeness, because that's a pretty presumptuous to think that we could discover wholeness and fullness. But there's always something God is going to be bringing to bear on what we're struggling with. So he actually called this God entity, the self, which is capitalized, to distinguish it from the small self. He didn't want to talk of God because he didn't want to be that presumptuous to establish some sort of theology, but this was the God image as it appeared internally and to us. And his conceptualization of how this appeared was in terms of whole symbols or totality symbols. Has anyone seen the mandala that the Tibetan Buddhists use as a worship symbol? It's sort of a circular, it has all sorts of complicated elements to it, but it's a symbol of totality, sort of a cosmic totality. Another way symbols of wholeness begin to appear is in terms of force or quaternaries, squares of various sorts. But they'll appear in all sorts of unifying ways. Another dream that I had was, remember I talked about the witch, and I would be going up the stairs to my little bedroom, and I'd be running past the box room where all the terrible things were, particularly the witch. And I always had a feeling that the witch would drop a black scissors down on top of me, because the sewing room is just by the box room. And the witch would have got black scissors, white scissors, dropped them down and pulled it at me. And in one stage of my analysis, I had a dream that I was on a boat with four people on it, and we were on a perfectly still body of water, and I couldn't see any land anywhere, and you could see down to the bottom, and you could see sand on the bottom, perfectly clear water, and down the bottom, I dived off the boat, and down the bottom was scissors with one black handle and one silver handle. So again, it was a linking symbol. And drawing. So these are sort of dreams that you just can't forget. I'm going to suggest if I come back to Holden that I do some dream workshops. If you come back, have a chance to explore some of these images in your own dreams. But again, that was the uniting symbol, a bringing together symbol. But not a symbol of total wholeness, because of course there's other ways, other unitings that have to be done. See, the snake dream has different elements to the blades of scissors. Okay. So is everyone okay in general with the general aspects of the theory?
Yeah. Any questions?
Okay. Can you see how God comes in the state when we just can't make sense of one side of ourselves from the other side of ourselves, or one point of view from another point of view? And we have to sit in that terrible tension, wait, and that's where as a Christian that would be a place of prayer, waiting prayer, contemplative prayer.
Are these repetitive dreams that you have, or is it just one-time occurrence?
No, these dreams for me were just one time. Usually shadow dreams are the repetitive dreams. Like I talked about my witch as my shadow figure, and those dreams went on and on and on for about 15 years, and you must all be aware of frightening dreams that recur again and again and again. It's when the shadow is beginning to assimilate is when you have these numinous dreams. Sort of a breakthrough. You don't quite know what it's all about until much later on. Of course, the Bible is full of this. You know, the Bible's full of people having dreams. You know, there's a whole tradition of divine revelation comes through dreams. And they didn't worry about it. We have to build a psychological theory. They just sat down with the priests or the wise persons and interpreted dreams. The Australian Aborigines have a concept that we live in a dream, but actually dream time is all around us. And in their native state, you know, when they're not civilized, in the mornings they get up and they have a dream period where they sit around and talk about the dreams that they've had during the night. And all their paintings, if you've seen any Aboriginal art, did you see any Aboriginal art when you were down there? Yeah. All their paintings are depictions of the dream time. So that, another way to really think about it is that we do live in a certain sort of a dream, in a way. But the dream is depicting aspects of ourselves, and then we get to play them out in real life and think of them as real. So in a certain sense, I think the Aborigines are correct, that we're living in a dream time. Okay?
Maybe we should take them as a model and do more of this ourselves.
Right.
Help each other interpret.
Right. Well, I think this is what various types of spiritual practice that we do here. Like that service last night, just before getting to bed, with candles here, and get a chance to do that while you're here. It's just a wonderful experience. And the Vespers in the evening, and you know, having a service in the morning, too. It's all centering yourself on this holy world, that inside us and without us.
Do you feel that all dreams are important then in bringing a message to us, or are some just sort of frivolous?
No, absolutely not. The patient says, I had a frivolous dream. I said, tell me all about it. Because that's often a shadow dream that the ego thinks is frivolous, you see. So anything the ego says, always take with a grain of salt. So, there's nothing frivolous that's going on in dreams. There's always something that's being said.
What about dreaming and then it's so wonderful and you wake up and you want to continue it?
That's right. That's right. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Like some of the numinous dreams are like that. Some dreams, though, are just wonderfully pleasant, and they're like a type of a mystical merging type of dream. It's not sort of bursting in on us like the scissors dreams for me or the snake, but it's a wonderful golden presence. It's like a meditation. Okay, so let's do some practical things. I can't demonstrate psychoanalysis to you, but I could begin to start to show you what might occur if you end up with a psychoanalyst. What a psychoanalyst is trying to do is he or she is trying to bring your mental state to life. So he or she is trying to help you enter what we call psychological reality, which is a bit like what we're talking about with dream time with the average. He's not going to, I'll keep saying he because it's just, I'm talking about myself. He's not going to say back to you things in conversational way. And he's not going to give you advice. If he starts to give you advice, he's then being pulled into what we call the real world, the real day-to-day world. We're trying to help a patient come out of that so-called real world, which is the ego's world, into the world of the total mind, and of course into the world of the holy and the spiritual eventually. So a psychoanalyst can be a very disconcerting character when you first meet them. And the old sort of adage that psychoanalysts didn't say anything is partly true, and that's a rigid form of psychoanalysis. We nowadays say a lot more than we did, especially in this model of psychoanalysis where we're amplifying aspects of the patient's presentation, aspects of the shadow.
You're starting to tell us what the psychoanalyst can do for us.
Yeah.
But how do we go about actually choosing
right. Are
going to come to it?
You guys asked all the right questions. I forget. So that's a very difficult part, choosing an analyst. And often it doesn't work the first time. And often you do it in probably the wrong ways. You go to a lecture or you read a book or something like that, and you get a very big attraction to that particular person. That's how I got started. I went to a lecture with a very charismatic person and got into analysis with him. And once I was in analysis, he wasn't nearly as charismatic as he was talking to me. And I stayed a year. I tried to make it work. And then finally got into the analysis with that person I did my whole analysis with. So it does take time. And there's got to be a fit. And if you're a Christian, obviously there's got to be a sense that there's a deep spiritual aspect to the analytic work. It doesn't have to be necessarily with a Christian. Because many Jungian analysts aren't necessarily Christian. They're all sorts of different religious denominations, some of Eastern denominations. So you have to be, if you're Christian and you want this experience, you have to be with someone in a spiritual way. But an analyst who has a spiritual relationship is not like a Christian therapist. Because a Christian therapist will be working, this is in a stereotypical way, will be working with your ego. Be trying to get your ego back on the path. And the Jungian analyst, the spiritually oriented analyst, will be trying to bring your shadow to life. So trying to bring your worst aspects to life. So that's not what Christians are supposed to show, their worst aspects. Even though Christ spent most of his ministry bringing all the worst so-called people into his orbit. That was what he was most interested in. Show me the sinners, they're the ones I'm interested in. So we're doing the same thing in spiritually oriented analytic work. We're bringing the sinners of your mind, of the patient's mind, to life. Okay. But first of all, we're bringing this strange thing called the psychological world to life. Now let's see if we can get some idea of what the psychological world might be, as distinct from the so-called real world. Now remember, the real world is the world of the ego. And the psychological world is the world of the ego and the shadow, the whole kit and caboodle. How might we bring that to life? What might that look like?
Maybe it's the two voices within that are carrying on a discussion.
That's right. So how might you get some clues as to what's going on there? If you were the psychoanalyst.
When it becomes painful.
What was that?
When it becomes painful.
When the patient starts to feel pain, psychological pain. So what might you ask them?
What's hurting today? Right.
What's hurting? And what might they tell you?
I don't want to talk about it.
And why might they want to talk about it?
Because it hurts too much.
They're embarrassed. Go ahead.
Okay, it hurts. And what type of hurt might it be? An embarrassment? What type of hurt?
Guilt producing.
Guilt. Right. And what part of the mind produces embarrassment and guilt for the poor old ego?
Shadow.
The shadow or superego, remember? The negative part. So as soon as the patient starts to tell you that, you're moving into the shadow figure, so the superego.
They also don't want to take responsibility for what their life is like.
Right.
They realize that they are part of that.
So the ego has a relationship with the shadow, and that the shadow is part of the whole mind. So they might have done things that they don't want to acknowledge. But here, the first thing you've got, as soon as the patient walks in, if you don't respond in a social way, the superego will pop its head up like a rocket, and there it'll be. And then you've got a chance to then begin to get to know the superego. So superego is all the nasty, persecuting, horrible parts of the shadow. So it's fairly simple. In the first session, usually the superego has arrived, he or she has declared all the different rules and regulations that has for the ego, all the things that make the poor old ego embarrassed, guilty, ashamed, all those sorts of things. And that relationship is brought into psychological reality. The idea? Because the patient thinks it's real reality. I should be embarrassed. I should be guilty. No. I am really a bad person. This is why I'm depressed and anxious and have no meaning in my life. So the first few sessions are fairly easy as the superego gets rolling. And it only gets rolling by you restraining and then inquiring about the patient's inner world. The patient's family or gang, really. It's more like a gang. It's not family. It's more like a gang that's attacking you. And then what's the other place that the patient might attribute that blame or shame is coming from when they're sitting down with somebody? You have ever had this experience?
I have no answer.
They feel the patient has no answer?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what might that
do? To whatever sure. causes of frustration or anxiety.
Right, right. I feel helpless. Helpless. The ego says I'm helpless, weak. And what did we hear about shadow figures when we asked people about their dreams the other day? What are they like? Are they helpless and weak?
No.
So this is another very important aspect of this type of psychoanalysis, is that it's not a weakness of the ego, it's a splitting off of the ego's strength. So that we have crocodiles and...
Mine's a bear.
What was that?
Mine's a bear.
Bear, there we go, we've got another animal. Any other animals?
Bull.
Bull, there we go. All right, any others? Bulls and bears are very common, yeah.
And sharks.
Sharks, right. Right. So, you see, a lot of psychotherapy, regular psychotherapy, works on building up the strength of the ego, making a person feel better by working on the ego. But in the shadow, there's all these guys, all gals, rushing around. That's where the strength of the ego has been split off. Because this is a kid that wasn't allowed, especially young girls. I have a patient right now that has a figure in her shadow as a fastball pitcher, baseball pitcher. And that, of course, when she was 12, she was told, you know, she couldn't pitch any longer. She used to play with the boys and throw fastballs, and that was a so-called tomball. And that's been split off. And she has a fantasy that she wanted to have a fencing match with me, and all sorts of aggressive things that she wants to do. So this is another very important aspect of the model of the mind that we're putting forward here, is that the person is never weak. It's just the strength has been split off. The strength has to be reclaimed through this process of the ego and the shadow coming together with the help of the transcendent function. Okay. Now, there's another way that psychoanalysis works that you might have heard about. Have you heard of what's called the transference? Does anyone know what that might be? No? Does it think
of the hands where the patient would transfer his feelings toward of someone on the therapist?
That's right. That's right. Originally, it was Freud's that he thought it was transferring feelings about parents onto the therapist. Of course, it's transferring feelings about anyone that you're associated with. But remember what's happened. Remember what's happened? That the person that you are associated with that developed the self is actually sitting inside your head? Right? So actually, you're what we call projecting. You're projecting part of yourself out onto the therapist. Of the analyst. And so in the beginning, you're always projecting the horrible superego out onto the analyst. And the analyst thinks everything you've got to say is bunk, and you know that you're a shameful person, and all that sort of stuff. So it's very important now, and this is getting to what actually happens in the later stages, is that you're working with the patient because you're bringing to life shadow aspects of the patient. Shadow aspects of the patient come to life inside the mind of the analyst, because they're attributed to the analyst by the patient. As you sit with the patient, these sorts of feelings start to come to life in you. You're bringing them to life. Is that too difficult an idea? Sit down with each other. Husband and wives probably shouldn't do this together. Sit with friends and you'll see this. If you don't say anything, you'll slowly start to get feelings about each other. And these will be different aspects of yourself that are being attributed backwards and forwards. This process of transference and projection is not something that goes on in psychoanalysis. It's brought to life there because the analyst doesn't relate in the normal social way to the patient. So the analyst purposefully trying to bring this inner life into the dialogue, into the interpersonal dialogue, but it's always there in the interpersonal dialogue. So that's why marriage is such an incredibly difficult thing. Because as we go beyond the social facade that the ego does quite well, all the shadow starts to come out. So marriage is nature's form of psychotherapy.
You know, as we talk about this, I've been thinking about you know, the biblical injunction to confess to one another.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
And if that wasn't something like this...
Exactly.
And the Bible doesn't say this is optional.
No.
And the Catholic Church took and institutionalized.
That's true. You're right. Exactly.
And if we would practice this more with each other,
that's right.
It would be that's probably right. More healthy.
So what's difficult for the analyst, and we'll finish up on this, and you're leading me right in. This is a terrific group of your questions. What an analyst has difficulty doing is taking in some of the shadow figures of the patient. And this is where we get to the ideas we were talking about before, is taking in the face of the other, the difficult face of the other. And a lot of psychoanalytic training is just helping analysts be able to tolerate taking in things that are awful about the patient. Just recently, I had a terrible projection into me, that I was a corrupt person. I'm the director of training at the Seattle Psychoanalytic Institute, and this patient of mine has a very low opinion of that institute. And I was appointed director after her analysis started. So I was a representative or a person right in the midst of something dreadfully corrupt. And this was the hardest thing recently. I've had to take in horrible things in the past, but this was really hard. And I actually couldn't take it in. It was too horrible to take in. And the patient was very upset with me, and I couldn't figure out why. And she said, "You dropped me." And what I actually dropped, really, was the opportunity to bring this alive. I couldn't bring this issue alive for her inside myself. And then subsequently, I could. And I amplified myself as a corrupt creature in all the different ways I was corrupt. And of course, this was a corrupt figure in her own mind. This was all sorts of corrupting and corrupted experiences. There was a whole series of this, these experiences. So this has opened up a whole new area of her analysis, whole sets of traumas that she's had with corrupting and corrupt figures. She goes backwards and forwards. It's not over yet.
Are you still working with her?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she thinks I'm corrupt in other ways. She's been I'm okay now as a training group. I'm corrupt in other ways. So this is where the dialogue goes backwards and forwards. This is taking in the patient taking in the analyst, and always discussing and trying to understand and trying to develop this problem and trying to bring these opposites into conjunction, because many times the analyst is just totally helpless when these things occur. They're just so profound, so intense, and the only thing is to wait back and wait for the dreams and wait for the images, the transcendent function of God appearing in the dreams. Many people in analysis will do lots of artwork too and lots of journaling. So that the analysis just goes on and on through the week. And so images will come in through the dreams. Not through the dreams, but through the artwork as well. A benign image that came in, actually it was just purely a color originally, that I was light blue. It was for the same patient, a good image of me, that I was actually light blue. And that gradually evolved it into a light blue heart. And we're still working on what light blue actually means for her. But that came out of her own spontaneous art, which is the same as letting the dream emerge in the daytime. And the journaling, of course, will do the same sorts of things. But another way that God's very important, and we haven't mentioned, we've mentioned this a little bit in the forum, is as the container of all this process, because this process isn't an easy thing for people to go through. So the analyst has to sort of, while being the object of projections and bringing projections to life and bringing the opposites together, has to try to contain all this stuff. And that's often a very difficult task, but that's a very important task. And eventually when the spiritual work starts to take hold, because everybody who's suffering in this way feels alienated from God. They feel that God doesn't want them. So slowly as God comes back into the picture, the holding of God becomes stronger. And so the analytic work can go deeper at that point. Also the eruptions of the transcendent function can be more disturbing as time goes on. But that holding part is just vital. It's the mother of God type feeling that has to be there. So that was a very brief discussion of contemporary psychoanalysis and coming closer to God. And so still have time for 5 minutes of questions.
The person recognizes the qualities that they think you have, uh-huh, and then eventually realize they're part of themselves and acknowledge that.
The qualities you have are what we call the hook on which the projection gets put. And then the projection slowly comes to life inside you. You'll say things like, "I feel like I'm something, da 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 da, a very corrupt person," for example. And then the patient will say, "Yes, you are, da 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 da." And then you'll say, "Well, in what way am I a corrupt person?" And then they'll start to amplify and describe how you're corrupt. Do all these sorts of different corrupt things, and that figure of a corrupt person will come to life.
Okay.
And be a person that you can then talk about. It actually moves out of the analyst's body, it's not real about the analyst, and becomes something the patient can begin to relate to. Get the idea? That's the unreal world. Then it goes back into the patient. The patient says, "You really are corrupt. It's not because you're a terrible director of the analytic institute, but because of some other thing I noticed you did." So it becomes real again. And what you're trying to do is to get these figures, these shadow figures, to be the dreaming figures into the unreal world. This is where the journaling comes in, the artwork comes in. They can depict the figures outside of themselves. See what I mean?
Okay.
A bit like what the Aborigines are doing with their drawings, their paintings. Okay.
I lived long enough to see a change in the way medicine looks at us, mostly with medical doctors. And there was this great find of psychosomatic medicine.
Right.
And I contended, I wrote a paper 20 years ago saying we haven't gone far enough yet. We need to expand the word to Neumann psychosomatic. It's just one word where it's spirit, mind, and body.
That's right.
Do you see this happening?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, what you talked about today would kind of support that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The body is always represented and symbolized. One of the most horrible things is that we actually separate our mind from our body. This is where Descartes' philosophy, I think, comes from. Yeah. The poor old Descartes is a lonely guy sitting in front of his fire by himself. He was never married. He didn't have a partner. He developed this theory of the mind separate from the body. And when patients' minds are coming back into the body, all sorts of psychosomatic things erupt. And reclaiming the body is a very big part of psychoanalysis, because our bodies are often denigrated, sort of hidden, felt to be ugly, you know, you name it. And we get all these things coming at us from the time we're born. And also, just even with our mothers, the way our mothers might handle our bodies can get all sorts of terrible attributions to how we feel about our body.
Okay, just a comment about you. You know, in the early part of this session, you said, if you come back to Holden,
mm-hmm.
And I want to encourage you to come back. This has been very enlightening. I think you have a lot to offer people who come here. So I hope the experience has been good, and that sometime in the future, I realize your schedule is busy, but I hope you do come back.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. We like you as director of
training. I want to thank you because you've been such a wonderful audience. And whenever I get off track, someone asks a question and brings a whole lot of things to you. You've struggled through it, and it's really been a stimulus and a joy to teach, or not to teach, to be with, really. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.